From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a phone call. A young woman had barely unpacked her bags after arriving at Northwestern University when she started to question herself. She had just graduated from Spelman College with a degree in music history and had planned to pursue a master's degree in vocal performance, but self-doubt had set in. 3 days before classes started, she called her parents. "I'm coming home," she told them. But she didn't. Whatever was said between renowned soprano Kirsten Piper Brown and her parents that day convinced her to stay at Northwestern. It was there that she met legendary performer and teacher William Warfield. As she told our former colleague Jeff Spivak in 2016, quote, "I worked with him for a year. There were only 3 students in the class, and it was bananas for me. We got to completely monopolize his time. We even got him to sing for us," end quote. In addition to solidifying her commitment to her career pursuits, Brown says Warfield taught her a valuable lesson that music should be enjoyable, not just competitive, and that there's something deeper to it. If you look at Brown's opera career over the last number of years, you'll see the expression of that deeper meaning, from the signature role of Bess in Porgy and Bess to Netta in I Pagliacci to Harriet Tubman. Brown has traveled the world bringing stories to life, performing at London's Royal Festival Hall, the Kennedy Center, the Met. But as she'll tell you, there is more to life than music. In 2015, she and her family moved to Rochester. She's a mother of 2, a very active parent in the Rochester City School District. In fact, perhaps you've heard her on this program talking about some of the advocacy work. She's a role model for aspiring artists. And you've probably heard her on WXXI's Classical 91.5, a host and announcer. She's also writing a book about the performer's mindset. This conversation has been a long time in the making, and we're honored to be joined by our esteemed colleague, Kirsten Piper Brown. Welcome to you. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, glad to be here.
Kirsten, I have to tell you, I am 100% more nervous for this interview than I would be if I was interviewing Kamala Harris or Donald Trump.
Oh, come on.
I don't feel like I'm necessarily qualified, and I'm so impressed by your work. So I just want to say thank you for making the time and being generous with your time and for juggling a lot of things here. So thank you. How are you these days?
I'm good. We are fighting to stay well. It's the COVID research.
How much COVID is out there right now? There's so much COVID.
Well, there's about, I'd say, 2/5 in my house right now. So, yeah, there is quite a bit. So trying to stay well.
And that's the reason that Kirsten is not right next to me in studio right now.
Right.
In a moment, I do want to let listeners hear. We have several clips that we're going to be playing here. And if you've never heard Kirsten, I want you to hear it. In a moment, we'll choose one. But before we do that, I just want to back up. And because the story of how you got into opera in the first place is, I mean, all these stories are always interesting to me, but yours in particular, even when you considered yourself perhaps a singer, it wasn't like you were 6 years old and you were thinking opera, opera, opera. That took some time, right?
Absolutely. My mom knew that I was a singer before anyone else did, as I made fun of Johnny Mathis, recording of his Hallelujah chorus, and he sang the tenor line so loud in the microphone, and my ear at the age of 6 or 7 knew that that was not the melody, and so I would sing the melody just to kind of balance it out, and my mom would just kind of look like, you know what you're doing over there, you know. So, but it took until well after graduating from college that I even considered a career in opera.
What do you remember the moment that you first, attempted to sing an operatic voice? I mean, were you in a car thinking like, maybe, or were you pushed that way in a class by a professor? How did that happen?
I've been pushed since I was maybe, in high school. I'd say I did all state chorus, I was always in the top choir, but I just enjoyed it. And I'm like, okay, well, this is what happens when you enjoy it and you work hard, you get to be in the top choirs. And, but I never really saw it as a career path. I didn't see it around me happening. I didn't see where I had access to it. And even in college, going to an all Black women's college, Spelman College, where it's like, the mecca for Black women, I still didn't grasp it as this is something that I as a Black woman can do. It's something that I thought would be really cool, but I wanted to do something impactful, and I didn't know that this was an impactful career. I do know now, but I wanted to do something like be a lawyer or a doctor or something like that, you know, what we're all kind of conditioned to do, right? So it wasn't until I really learned about how music can heal, how music can change, how music can have an impact in people's lives that I decided that it's a gift that I had that needed to be utilized before I lost it.
Well, can we listen to one of the first clips we have here? We're going to listen to The Rake's Progress from Stravinsky. This is from the Lakes Area Music Festival, I think.
Yeah, it just finished about last month.
So let's listen to The Rake's Progress, and we'll come back and talk to Kirsten. Good Lord.
That wasn't even my best one.
It wasn't they your best one.
They recorded the wrong performance. No, not the wrong. But that's, you know, that's the beauty of live. You capture it, all the mistakes. And I heard them. You didn't. I did.
You're absolutely right about that. You know, so let's talk about this idea of how you get young people to maybe see themselves with this opportunity. Because as you just said, I mean, this wasn't something even at Spelman, you weren't thinking opera. As a young girl, you weren't thinking this. But you said way back when you were 5 or 6, you wanted to be a ballet dancer, and your parents took you to, I think, the Kennedy to see the Dance Theater of Harlem. What do you remember about that?
Oh my gosh, the most magical time in life. We would, you know, if I got a graded report card, which I always did, I was always promised tickets to the Kennedy Center when they came, and we would go pick out a dress. I got little bobby socks. I got my little patent leather shoes. And we'd go out for crab legs because that's what I wanted to eat before sitting in the box seat at the Kennedy Center Opera House. I wanted to eat crab legs. And so we go get crab legs, and my mom, my father, and I, and we would sit, and I would just be mesmerized. And my favorite piece has always been Firebird. And I'd not been really exposed to classical music in the home, at home, that much, but I was just so captivated by, you know, every year I had to see Firebird. So,
and when you, you know, you're getting older, when you get to 10, 11, 12 years old, you're obviously still not thinking opera, but take me through some of the evolution of seeing possible path to a musical future for yourself.
Yeah, I went to my first, musical, Broadway musical in high school, and I was in a choir. I had played, you know, the violin. I had played the flute in middle school, a little bit in high school, and that's when I first saw the joy, really, of being on stage with music and dancing and acting. And that's what I wanted to do. I discovered Audra McDonald soon after that, and I was like, I'm just going to be her, like. That she is me and I am her. didn't quite make that. I studied music history in college because I think I just didn't really, again, didn't really see myself, didn't have the confidence in myself. And I considered myself to be more bookworm, a nerd. I wanted to do research. I wanted to write. And so that's what I kind of committed myself to academically. Things changed when I got to actually worked at National Public Radio, worked for Fred Child and Performance Today as an editor. And I got FOMO from calling Renee Fleming's agent, from calling all these people's agents, trying to get them to come into the studio and, oh, she's in Hong Kong doing a recital, or so-and-so is doing it at the Opera Paris. And I'm like, well, I can do that. And of course I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking about doing it seriously. I applied for graduate school, got in, and was okay with the fact that I could do it if I wanted to. Fast forward a year later, I just decided, like, it's now or never. I quit my job at NPR. I just got a promotion, moved to Northwestern, you know, moved into my apartment in Chicago. And after the first couple of days of school, I was like, this is not it. But I did it because it's hard. And that's kind of what I'm known for. I'm known for the person that does the hard things. And that's what I kind of inspire other people to do, I hope, is to do the hard thing.
Well, you told in 2020, you told Kevin Ray Johnson that you had given up a sought after promotion and literally, mm-hmm. quote, just dared myself to dive into the challenge of a career in opera. Yep. And here we are. Yes. End quote. I would like to challenge the idea that you went from that challenge to just here we are. I think there was something in between.
There was lots of things and lots of money.
What did people around you say when you really got serious about opera?
Well, I'll say that I was fortunate to have parents who, while they didn't necessarily have the financial means to support me, they definitely were supportive in the idea of me being an opera singer. They knew that I was talented. You know, they drove with me to Chicago. They're like, you know what? We can't necessarily help you pay this rent or pay that tuition, but we got your back. You know, we'll come in and cook for you. Well, you know, drop some money into your account for groceries every now and then. But they saw how hard I was working. And they really inspired me just knowing that they had my back and that they would be there for me if I failed. And also just knowing that because I love doing so many different things, I had backup plans, I guess, in the back of my head. But I just had that drive and I had the support of people. I had my professors at Northwestern, my professor at Spelman College, Laura English Robinson, who called me and said, finally, you figured it out. She was very upset that I was not a music performance major at Spelman. And she figured that I would come around and she was right.
Talking to Kirsten Piper Brown, kirstenpiperbrown.com, the website. Where do you want people to find your work most often if they're looking for you right now?
Right. So my website is getting a big makeover. It's going to be shiny and new, hopefully in the next week. So my website is not necessarily up to date, but I do keep my social media up to date. Kirsten Piper Brown on Instagram and Kirsten Piper Brown Soprano on Facebook is where I kind of keep my fans up to date for now.
You
until
can say
I get
that.
My website redone.
Yeah, you can say that.
Okay, sure.
Fans. You got fans. Kirsten, I want to go back to something I mentioned as well in the introduction, and I want to go back to something that I think you have said that came from William Warfield, which is this idea that that music is so competitive. Opera is competitive. Music is competitive. It's competitive at Eastman. It's competitive everywhere you go. And it's got to be enjoyable. It's got to be joyful. It can't just be competitive. And that really struck me. I'm thinking a lot now about how to try to raise a 12-year-old who, you know, he's got a sport he loves, but it's like, do you love it or are you always worried about not either FOMO or how you compare to others? And there are so many pursuits that kids and then adults get into. And, you know, my fear is that so many of these pursuits become less about the joy and more about how do you measure, how did you get into this college? Did you not? Did you get this role? Did you not? You know, you're part of the ensemble or are you a lead? You know, and it can sap the joy. I mean, my friend's daughter just started school in college a couple days ago, and I love her. I'm worried for her. I think she's going to be great, but I want her to still find joy in music, and it's so competitive. How have you done that, and have you had moments where it didn't feel as joyful and it felt just mostly competitive?
Yeah, I think the time that it felt least joyful for me was around the time that I was having my children and trying to figure out motherhood and life, and really suffering from what so many of my colleagues who are parents, specifically mothers, that mom guilt of pursuing your dream and, you know, doing your best to close out and mute the voices around you that might, you know, tell you you need to be a good wife or you need to be a good mother and you need to, you know, focus on your kids. And I wanted to find a way to do it all. And so I did kind of tell my agent, like, hey, I need to figure this out. I need to sit back just for a little bit, throw me a couple of things, but know that I can't handle everything right now until I get my mind together. And this is something that I share with a lot of parents who want their young children to study with me. I don't take kids as students. I'll help, you know, work with and a particular audition, but I'm not a mean teacher, but I expect a lot and I don't want the intensity of it to, you know, shut a kid out of the joy of singing. So the thing I tell parents and tell, you know, young people, hey, get into choirs, just do it for the love of it. If it starts to stress you out, take a break, take a break. And for me, I did take that break. It started to be stressful, but I also knew that because, again, the theme here, doing hard things, I wanted to teach my children something and I didn't want to miss out on an opportunity for them to be proud of me, for them to see whatever legacy I build. And so it kind of switched on me when we were in Utah. I had two toddlers by myself on a gig where I'm doing two shows. So talk about stressed out and not sleeping and potty training one on the road. I don't recommend that. I was meeting one of the nannies that I hired, a college student, with her family at lunch. And I just kind of snuck into the restaurant and I overheard my oldest son, Miles, who was 4 at the time, bragging about me to some random stranger in a cafe. And that's when it kind of switched on me, like, okay, I can do this because it's bigger than myself. And my children see what I'm doing. And I heard another story of one of my, with my youngest, Avery, his teacher, pre-K teacher called me. He was in 3-year-old pre-K at school, 53. He said, guess what we did at the end of school today? It's like, we watched YouTube videos of you and Avery curated everything. And so he directed them to videos. And, oh, she's singing in this language. No, it wasn't that language. It was probably French, but he said German or whatever. But he was proud to take his classmates through whatever discography he could find on YouTube of me. And so for me, that's awesome. When I found more of the joy in it and less of like the guilt and like, this is just a job. You know, this is something that I should be proud of, that my family's proud of. And, you know, to just, I started to be like a beautiful thing again for me.
That's the best when your kid can't wait to show other people. That's so cool. You know, like, and sorry, listeners, this is not a political statement. It's a family observation. I think that's why the Gus Walls moment at the Democratic National Convention resonated so hard with people. Mm. You know, looking up saying, that's my dad in tears. When you get your kid saying, I'm going to look at you, you got to listen to this and I want to show you this. This is my mom. That's my mom. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. tell people why Rochester. How did you, I mean, because, you know, that's not where you grew up. Why did you end up in Rochester?
Oh man, I've been all around. So number one, got married, not here in Rochester, but my husband is employed at the medical center at University of Rochester. We actually moved here in 2014. I had a toddler and he was an infant, 6 months old. And so I was like, yeah, I mean, we were living in Iowa and I was kind of like, yeah, anywhere else, right? Let's go. And so Rochester was it. And I was very excited. I did some research, found out it was quite a musical town and thought I'd settle in very well, you know, career-wise, which actually did not really happen for me locally. It was really settling the family and settling the kids in and really just, you know, taking it in. It's a different city than I've ever lived in. It's just really different here. I've learned to enjoy it and get active. And rather than complain about the things that I saw that I didn't like, I decided to get involved where I could. You know, it's great here. I mean, my kids love it here. We're, you know, we're having a good time. I'm running all through this city.
Well, and I could go down the long list, which we'll talk more about coming up here, of everywhere that you have performed. But as your career has blossomed, how many people in professional circles have said to you, you know, you should be living at X or you should be living at Y. Why are you where you are? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I hear this. I've heard this a lot, not so much now because I've established myself enough to where I can really live anywhere and just have an airport near me, get to where I wanted to. But my voice teacher, back when I, you know, first graduated from college and grad school and had to like pay actual like money for my voice lessons on a weekly basis in New York City, urged me to move to Europe. And I did consider it because at, you know, I would say at a time, and actually maybe a little bit now still, Black opera singers did better in Europe, were more accepted, got work a little bit easier. There are more opera houses to work in Europe. And so I considered it, but in the back of my head, I said, if I can't work in this country, I don't want to do it. You know, I don't want to have to move to some other country. You know, my father fought in a war in the United States, and, you know, I'm going to sing here just like he fought for his country. And so I made a commitment to doing whatever I could here in the United States. I kind of made my career doing Porgy and Bess, which was an opera that many older Black opera singers would tell young singers to stay away from because it's the type of opera that can pigeonhole you out of doing a Mozart, out of singing Puccini, because they see you as a Black opera singer because the roles are all Black and you'll never do anything else. Well, I challenged that because guess what? It was money and I had bills. So I did many Porgy and Besses across Europe. And that really, those performances are what gave me the attention. It gave me the opportunities to then sing in front of agents and then open the world up to me to the interpretation of wonderful American works, which is where I've kind of pinned myself as, I would say not myself, others have pinned me as a great interpreter of American works, which now has come to new works. I get called to do new works so many times, and I love it because there's no blueprint. No one's going to say, oh, that Callas recording was better, that Fleming recording was better. No, my recording, me, that's it. But I'm now able to, this year, I have no new works, which is weird. I'm doing all Puccini and Verdi this coming season. And I'm kind of like, oh man, I want like a new work. But I was complaining a couple seasons ago that I didn't have any Puccini and Verdi. So here we go.
We're talking to Kirsten Piper Brown, who says her website's under construction. So if you go to kirstenpiperbrown.com, you probably need to return in a few weeks and you'll see it revamped. But you can find Kirsten on different social platforms. Occasionally you'll hear Kirsten Piper Brown filling in on WXXI's Classical 91.5, and we love that. In a moment we're going to listen to, well, I think we're going to start with some Intimate Apparel, if we could. Is that all right with you?
Totally.
PBS fans may have seen Intimate Apparel on PBS's Great Performances. Set in Manhattan, 1905. You are Esther Mills in this, right?
Yes.
Tell the story a little bit and then we'll listen to some.
Yeah, so this is a wonderful new work by Ricky Ian Gordon and Lynn Nottage, two of my favorite creators in the entire world. I felt very privileged to bring the role of Esther to life. This opera takes place in the early 1900s. A woman, Esther, who's a spinster, she's in her 30s, not married yet, and starts receiving letters from a gentleman working the Panama Canal. And they're just so beautifully written. She sends fabrics from her seamstress work, and he talks about how they look like the skies and, you know, all these poetic things. He comes to New York City to marry her, and he is not the man who he says he was. In fact, he didn't write those letters. I'm not sure if that's the clip we're going to hear, but Esther does confront him finally that, you know, you're not the man in these letters, and he's after her because she has one. She's kind of like a self-made woman in a way, which was at that time, for a Black woman was not that common for a woman to be her own businesswoman. And she has all this money saved up. And she says she's going to open a beauty parlor. But this man tells her, like, you're not going to do that. You're too ugly. You should give it to me and, you know, let me invest it. And it doesn't end well, just say that.
The reviews are so beautiful. The New York Times said that Brown is especially heartbreaking as Esther and astonishingly tireless in a huge role. Her scenes are so gentle and rich in subtext, that you don't want them to end. The New York Theater Guide said Brown brings Esther's deepest yearnings to life with a warm soprano that continues to blossom, most particularly when she pleads for the love she deserves. Let's listen to a little bit from Intimate Apparel. How much do the kinds of reviews I just read matter to you, Kirsten?
They do now. I don't read reviews while I'm in production because I don't want to change anything that the director or music staff doesn't tell me. So I didn't know about the buzz except when people would tell me or call me, but I was honestly overwhelmed when the show ended. The final show, I just burst out into tears at the curtain call. I couldn't contain myself from the blubbery cry, but I got a chance to really sit and read through everything and didn't really know that what I had done. And then come the award nominations, and I believe it was Jesse Green in the New York Times, when the Tonys came out, you know, I was his biggest snub for best actress in a musical, because Intimate Apparel was done in an off-Broadway theater and not Broadway, and he thought that I should have won a Tony Award for my performance.
Amazing.
But
amazing.
Wrong theater.
The bias against the wrong theater. Wow. Listeners, you can watch the PBS version of Intimate Apparel on Passport, and you have Passport if you're a sustaining member of WXXI. So just another great reason to be a member. Let me also just ask you, you talk about being listed as the biggest snub for the Tonys. That to me feels like, you know, you're close to the pinnacle, but this is where my ignorance, and this is why I was nervous to talk to you. I'm not nervous to interview anybody, but like Kirsten Piper Brown. Well, I mean, like, this isn't my world. I'm amazed at what you do. But so let me ask you a clumsy question then.
Sure.
As your career has progressed, is there a pinnacle? It's like, well, you know, did the Met or Tony's or another venue or a particular role? Is there a pinnacle that you've looked at? Have you felt like you have reached it or them? I mean, I apologize for the clumsiness of the question.
No, this is a great question. I've been asked this for the past few years. And I would say if you asked me this like back in 2017, when I made my San Francisco opera debut, that was the pinnacle. And I was like, I did it. I sang it in a house after a very influential man in the opera business told me that I would never do so. I've since sung in five or six as of today. But, I felt like that was the pinnacle. I beat the odds, you know, but each time I thought singing Esther was the pinnacle, you know, being chosen to sing at this very well-known theater, Lincoln Center Theater, like, okay, no, that was it. Singing at the Metropolitan Opera, like, so I don't think there is a pinnacle for me. The pinnacle is when I'm done, when I'm tired of it. That's the pinnacle. And I'm not tired of it. It's still fun. I love it. But that's when I'm going to say, like, I've reached my peak, is I'm tired. I know that's weird to say that, probably not what you're expecting, but I feel like there's much more out there for me. I've not really made a major debut in Paris Opera. Like, actually emailed my agent, like, hey, let's work on this. I just came back from France. So I was like, I want to sing there. So I kind of like throw things at him, and kind of in the mindset work that I've done, which I hopefully will finish writing about soon. I talk to young singers and young musicians about imagining themselves on the stages where they want to be, or in whatever position that is, even if it's not being a performer, imagine yourself where that is and work from that place. Do not work up to it, work from it. And pull everything kind of up. I don't know if that makes sense, but like, pretend you're already there. Like, carry yourself as if you're already in that space. Open yourself up to the opportunities, you know, imagine yourself there dressed like someone who works there. And that was one thing that was really important for me, is doing mindset work. So I continue to do that. I continue to want to, I want to win a Grammy. Maybe that's a pinnacle. I don't know. When I win one, there'll be another pinnacle, but I haven't won a Grammy yet. So maybe that's coming.
I love the ideas that you just shared about, you know, dress like it, act like it, plan for it, prepare for it, you know, and that seems to be related to a question that comes up sometimes with, which is, how do you deal with if you are prone to imposter syndrome or looking around going like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe I'm on the stage, or, you know, can I do this? And, you know, maybe it's just the act of doing it. Maybe it's the more you do it, the more you know that you can, and you don't have to have those doubts, which might be natural. Did you ever have doubts when you were getting on a stage?
Absolutely. I still have doubts. Not as many, but I think definitely living the type of life I live, where I don't live in New York City, or I don't live in Milan, and I'm not like 100% dedicated to my craft, and that I have this wonderful distraction called motherhood, being a wife. And so that, in a way, I've flipped that on its head and kind of made that work to my advantage of, I have an outlet outside of the intensity of opera rehearsals, of sitting in a room and having to listen to my voice mess up and sing things and knowing I'm not getting it right. I can go home and go play with my kids. And so I, while I'm, you know, telling other people, you know, dress like it, be like it, I'm like down here in my, you know, soccer mom clothes, you know, like with the hat on out in the hot sun, like, when is this practice going to be over? But also, I now take my career and I think of it as like playing dress up. I think of it as, and this is where my new idea about my career has come in, especially since Intimate Apparel, is that I'm a storyteller. I'm not an opera singer. I tell stories. I tell stories. I take material, whether it's a libretto, whether it's the music, and I do the best I can, whether it's the director giving me the directions, and I tell a story to the best I can. And there's an audience in front of me that needs something. Maybe they need healing. Maybe they need the message in here. And so my job is not, you know, being up there and faking it and letting, you know, thinking about what criticisms are out there, because that's very real. You are thinking about, what do people think about me? Oh my gosh, I messed up. Because, you know, as you heard that performance I did, which was live, I'm like, oh my God, I'm cringing. Like, I messed that note up. Oh my God. But I had to flip it and say, you know what? I'm here. I'm telling a story. And somebody out there is going to get something out of it. I am giving a gift. But not only am I giving a gift, I am receiving a gift from the audience. And that helps me so much.
Couple questions from listeners. Colleen wants to know, how early can kids learn to sing opera?
Yeah, I would say not too early. I mean, the whole Charlotte Church thing that, you know, went around, and then there's another young woman. I think there's definitely a lot of raw talent out there, especially in children. And I see them and I hear them. I just caution against, I would say, private lessons with a teacher who will teach you quote unquote opera. If I have kids, I teach them about how to sing well, how to sing healthy with their voice, not like an opera singer. I would say, like, again, I said this earlier, the best thing for kids to do is get into a church choir, get into school choir, do things that are fun, do musicals. And that kind of, like, I think raises the fun meter when it doesn't get fun. And so you're already enjoying it. You don't want kids to start stressing about it earlier and being in that room in a box with the teacher at the piano and, you know, getting all the criticisms back. I mean, of course there's encouragement in teaching, but you're constantly correcting a child. And that's one thing I don't necessarily enjoy doing at length every week. Correcting. I want to make children sing better. But when I start to see that light dim, I say, you know what, we're going to take like a couple months off. And you're going to go sing in choir and you're going to love it. You're going to have fun. And I'll see you later. Because I don't want to do that to a kid. Mm. That's the worst.
Totally understand that. Anne writes to say, Evan, we loved hearing KPB. I love Let's go with this. I liked KPB.
Yeah.
Hearing KPB sing with the RPO Pops a few years ago. Hope she will be back to sing again and bring her voice and interpretation to more music for our Rochester audiences. That's Anne.
That was fun. I love Jeff. Tysick.
Would you go back? Do more?
Absolutely. I mean, it's home. You know, I remember the first time I sang with the RPO was, I think it was late 2021. And Omicron was going around, and I wasn't sure if this concert was even going to go on. It was the Holiday Pops, and so nervous coming in, and you know, everybody looking at me, and I'm looking at them. And I really, at first, I was like, oh my gosh, this orchestra doesn't like me. You know, I couldn't tell they had masks on. Mm-hmm. Like, all I could see were eyes, and everybody looked so intense. And then by the end of the concert, I'm like, hugging everybody, probably shouldn't have been, but whatever. I just played or sang actually that Rick's Progress included some RPO musicians that, you know, we got a chance to go like, wait, you're in Minnesota, get out of here. And so I feel like with the RPO musicians, I have, you know, great friends. I get to, you know, see them around somewhere. I get to see them around town. But yeah, I will always make room for an RPO appearance when I can.
Thank you, Anne, for the email. Tim says, I've never been to an opera. How can I teach myself to love opera?
Sorry. That's funny because I had the same question. And I'm an opera singer. I forced myself to listen to classical music while I was in school, like trying to be a classical musician. Like, do I even like this?
It's not, you know, broccoli, like, Kirsten.
It was broccoli. Okay. I'm gonna be honest. It was broccoli. Okay. But I knew that I could do broccoli, but I was like, do I like broccoli? I can do it. But I would say, like, find stories that are cool. Like, I always tell folks before you go to the opera, before you go to the symphony, even, each piece has a story behind it. You know, see if you're interested in hearing that story be told through music. Even if it's in a different language, I tell folks who've never been to an opera to try an English opera first, to try composers that might be a little bit, I guess, more tonal to the ear, so that you're not having to really think. I always tell people, don't sit in the orchestra seat, sit up high, because if you're watching an opera and you need to read the titles, you don't want your neck going up and down because you're trying to see the stage, you're trying to see what are they talking about, come back. So I tell people to sit, this little trick for all the listeners, sit up in the balcony. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, people don't want to sit in the balcony to think, like, you know, that's not a good seat. No, those are the best seats. The sound comes up there, sit up there. Okay. So I say, you know, find something in English and really, like, find a story that you think would be cool to listen to being told through music.
Well, let's listen to another clip here of Kirsten Piper Brown, my guest. Kirsten says she's a storyteller, not necessarily an opera singer, although, I mean, you're an opera singer.
That's right. I am. Okay.
Okay. Okay. And listeners have probably heard Kirsten filling in and announcing on WXXI's Classical 91.5. She has performed literally around the world and for most of the last decade has lived in Rochester. And we are so glad to claim her and her talent here. I want to listen to Qual Fiamma from the Florida Grand Opera in January. Just a short clip here. You want to tell us a little bit about Qual Fiamma first?
Yeah. So I think we're going to listen to Qual Fiamma as part of the recitative, which always sets up an aria that some composers will use to kind of set up like the main idea. So it's her contemplation of her love. This is an opera, I Pagliacci Netta, is trying to decide, like, you know, if she wants to stay with her husband because her husband picked her up, a traveling circus, gave her a job, kind of rescued her, but she loves someone else. And she realizes that if she reveals this to her husband, he will be so upset with her. And then she goes into this beautiful florid aria as she's distracted by birds. And it's so beautiful. And she just says she wishes that she could fly like birds and be free and not kind of be imprisoned in this circus that she's in, literally.
All right, let's listen to Qual Fiamma. Thank you. Is that clip any better for you? I know the first clip you didn't love of yourself.
Well, that one was okay. So that was the end. That was the end of the aria portion. And the aria, folks might know, is called Stridono Lassù. And yeah, that's the end where she's saying, and fly, and fly, and fly like the birds. So that was okay.
Okay. I did want to ask you about the different roles and the different stories that you can be a part of. So just... Again, in the spirit of the clumsy nature of questions, I apologize here, but the way I think about when I listen to classical, I love some of the stories behind some of the classical music that I love. And then there are some classical that I love that I have no idea what the story or the intention was behind it. So I can think of some Schumann, especially when he was dying, that he wrote. His last composition is a beautiful piece of music, but just knowing that story is even more moving. I think of a lot of what Shostakovich was doing and the context of the politics and the threats on his life. And I think about how powerful that is in that context. And then I think there's plenty that I listen to that I have no idea, but I think it's beautiful. Are you looking for not just great stories or characters, but, you know, sort of powerful meaning? Are you looking for the quality of the music and the challenge of the vocal components? I mean, how do you decide what you want to do?
Well, first of all, I decide if I need money. And if I need a job, I'll, you know, like, okay, well, this is going to go on the, yeah, we're going to highly consider this. But I do look at the story. I do look at the music. Do I like the music? Or maybe I don't know the music, because a lot of times I get a brand new score and I cannot just go and listen to the music. So, gosh, do I have the energy? Do I have the time? Do I really want to create something new? Usually, yes. That's really what's been driving me these past few years, is really creating something new, creating that blueprint for others to then listen to and mimic or do whatever they want with that. And then I look at companies. Do I want to work with a particular company? There are some companies, I don't want to work with. I see, you know, which colleagues are there. So a lot goes into, and then how much time am I going to be away from my family? Can I bring my family in? I try to do this like 3-week rule where I'm either home after 3 weeks for a certain number of a certain time, or my family comes to me after about 3 weeks. Cause sometimes my jobs can be anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks for a full opera. So, but yeah, I really am looking for a great story to tell. Something that I can really just jump into and really lose myself in. It's really therapy for me. I can kind of forget myself. And that kind of also helps with like all that stage fright, because it's not me, right? I'm somebody else, right? It's not me. So looking for wherever I can lose myself. Usually that's almost everything that I love to do. Mm. I don't turn a whole lot down.
I don't want to scare listeners when I tell this story, but so I was a little shocked when I Googled, or maybe I looked up on YouTube. So I was learning more. This was a number of years ago when I was learning that story of Shostakovich, and some of what put him in such trouble with the Russian authorities, and Stalin in particular, who thought the Lady Macbeth in the Mtsensk district was way too over the top and sexual. And I was not ready for just how much heat was in some of what I saw in that show, which you can find portions of online. But there's a lot of heat and a lot of romantic drama and pain in opera. I don't want to sort of overgeneralize here, but you know, I don't know if people are typically looking for a big political statement, or if they're just looking for gorgeous storytelling, but there's a wide range in the world of opera, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say the more gripping a story is, the harder it is to tell, the more taxing it is for a musician. That's also something that I have to consider. For instance, the story Fire Shut Up in My Bones, you know, tells about the trauma of childhood sexual abuse. And so for many of the cast members, or for all of us at the Metropolitan Opera, we had access to therapy. We had intimacy directors in the room to help us with some of the physical touch that happens during the opera. We had therapists, we had everyone to kind of help us to tell this really hard story. We check in with each other, check in with artists like, hey, how are you feeling today? Can I touch your arm here? Tell me where I can't touch, because it might be different today. You might be able to touch, my butt. And then the next day I'm like, no, I don't want to be touched there today. And so I think a lot of companies, and I'm so glad we're becoming more aware of how taxing it is for artists to tell these stories. After doing intimate apparel, that's probably the hardest role I've done, only because I had to do it in isolation. In New York City, we were isolated physically from family. We were kind of in our own pods as a cast. We tested, PCR tested daily in order to bring this story to life, because we did not want COVID to shut us down again as it had the first time. And so I spent a lot of time alone, and I started to feel like, this is not emotionally healthy. And so I started to feel that and had to really find ways, going to the gym upstairs in my, apartment, and really watching some trashy stuff online, like stuff I would never really watch on Netflix or other streaming channels, just to kind of take my mind out of the loneliness and the heartbreak that suffered, that Esther had to suffer, that I had to perform 6 days a week.
Love is Blind. That was a pandemic show that I cannot believe I watched. I was like, what are we doing?
I know. I've done it.
Why am I watching this? Oh my gosh.
Now I'm watching American Sweethearts. It's American actually really good about the Dallas Cowboys.
Sometimes you just got to find a way to turn your mind off, right?
I mean, exactly. It completely turned my mind off. Oh yeah. I loved it. It's great. Good entertainment.
So before we go here, a couple of things here. I want to ask you if it's gotten easier in the course of your career. And I wanted to be careful by asking this, because the last thing I would ever want is to be like, hey, we're talking to a black opera singer or a, a black woman who's in music, and as opposed to like an opera singer and she happens to be black, because you talked about not wanting to be, or people advising you, don't be pigeonholed. Don't narrow the scope of how people might see your work. And I don't think it would be fair to overly focus on that. But you did say that, in recent decades, it has been easier for black performers perhaps to be in Europe in this particular genre than in the United States. Has that changed in your career so far?
It has, but it took tragedy for it to change. It took I would say the marker was the murder of George Floyd. When the Black Lives Matter movement came about, no matter how you felt about it, it affected so many of us and affected Black artists in a great way, to where the things that we were saying, were finally displayed, like, here, this is what we were talking about. Like, look at this news story. I would say after that, opera companies, orchestras, they got their DEI staffs together, they started to pay attention to Black composers and hire more Black singers in roles that weren't just for Black singers. And so I would say that did get better. But at the same time, I mean, we're still, I feel like, in the honeymoon phase of it. I don't think that's a great word to describe, something that happened as a result of tragedy.
No, but I take the point.
We'll see where we settle. We've seen at the Metropolitan Opera, we've seen with Porgy and Bess, we've seen with Fire Shut Up in My Bones, how well those stories sell money. Having to add shows, and these shows just happen to be full of Black folks. So, hey, maybe Black folks should be on stage at the Met. maybe folks will buy tickets. Maybe Black folks are coming out to buy tickets, because we already know that in the Black community, we spend money on what we want to see. And I've advised those orchestras, those opera companies that have sought me for consulting, is, there's a whole audience you're ignoring, because they're not seeing something that relates to them, or they're not seeing themselves. And so, try putting Black folks in non-traditional roles that you wouldn't normally put Black folks in, or try a work by a Black composer that tells a story that is inherently Black, and see what happens to your ticket sales. So I don't know, it might work, might not work in all cases, but we've seen some fruit of that, I would say, across the industry. And I'm hoping that it lasts, but I would say more so what it has done, as I am very much a Black opera singer. I will say that if everybody wants to see me as a Black opera singer, and they can do so and label me as that, Black. I don't even like African-American. I just like being Black. And an example of this is when I did The Shining, by, story by Stephen King, mm-hmm. At Opera Parallel is where we premiered the reduction. I then did it at Atlanta Opera. I presented to the hair and makeup team and director like, hey, so I'm Wendy Torrance. Hi, I'm Black. Hi, can everybody see me? I know that you all intentionally knew that I was Black. So I will be an intentional Black mother in this opera. And I said, I'm really feeling an Afro. Can we work on that? And the director, the composer, everyone was like, oh my gosh, Wendy Torrance with the fro. Let's do it. It's amazing. Paul Moravec, the composer, came up to me and said, I never pictured Wendy Torrance with an Afro. I was like, dude, it's the 70s. Why not? So I'm Black. And so I'm being able to step in and really help artistically and creatively what the show even looks like. And it works. And because, I'm a Black woman, we found some wonderful Black singing actors as kids to also play my child. just doing that, we're really stepping back into the things that people told me not to do has been so refreshing, so freeing. Mm. It's taken the pressure off. And just really coming in with my hair in a head wrap, or wearing, I don't know, just really being who I am. I'll just say that. And I think it's really across all communities, we can now be who we are. And that's been the win.
I have so enjoyed this hour with you. And I am grateful that you are willing to make the time. Bob in Rochester wrote in to say, I love KPB. That is all.
Oh, thanks, right, Bob.
There you go. The KPB fandom is growing here. Kirsten Piper Brown, you can find Kirsten's work in a number of different places. We can't wait to see what you do next. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Kirsten Piper Brown, an amazing talent from the whole team at Connections. Thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow. It's Member Supported Public Radio is bringing you Environmental Connections and Jasmine Singer tomorrow.